Welcome to In the Thick. I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
And I'm Jamila King, and this is ITT Sound Off.
Yes, it's Friday, and Jamila is here, guest co-hosting. Maria's still doing the professional Hispanic tour. Hispanic Heritage Month is over as of Friday, but Maria still has professional Hispanic appearances. So, hey, Jamila.
Hey, Julio. Always happy to be here.
All right, so let's get to it with our first topic, which is an immigration update. So on Tuesday, the Department of Homeland Security issued a memo to essentially end workplace raids and mass arrests of immigrant workers. So the Biden administration has said they want to focus on businesses and employers that violate labor laws and exploit undocumented workers rather than targeting workers themselves. Well, that would make sense. Thank you. But it's important to know that under the former Trump administration, we actually saw mass raids in workplaces ramp up, including in 2019, where Immigration and Customs Enforcement, also known as ICE, arrested around 680 people at 7 food processing and poultry plants in our beloved state of Mississippi. So we want to shout out Latino USA's most recent episode, which dropped on Friday, and you can also listen to on the public radio stations around the country. And it's about the reporting that Maria Hinojosa, our fabulous, wonderful co-host of In the Thick, and producer Reynaldo Leaños Jr. did in Mississippi. They actually went to Mississippi to go back and report on the community that was impacted by the raids. You know, we did it the first time a year after the raids, and we decided to go back close to 2 years after the raids. So Maria spoke with some people she had met previously to see what happened in the aftermath of the raid. So this is her talking with Lorena Quiroz, who has been on the show with us as well on In the Thick when we did our live Mississippi show. And Lorena is the director of the Immigrant Alliance for Justice and Equity. So let's take a listen.
This plant, did it ever close down? Never. As a matter of fact, some of the people that were caught at the raids, they're back in there.
And she says she's heard about this from a lot of people in the area.
Okay, I need to know how that happens.
They would just pretty much pretend that they didn't know that they were part of the race. They were invited to come reapply. They actually went out and recruited, and they would talk to people. Hey, si conoce a gente que quiere trabajar, estamos trabajando, estamos pagando. People would show up. They would know who it was. But if you gave them a different ID, you would get hired.
Okay, wait.
When did that happen? When?
As COVID started to hit, because people were
right
getting
after,
sick.
Right after we left?
Right after you left.
So you're saying that right after we left, February of 2020, it was 6 months after the raid, and it was kind of like, no, things are not moving. They're asking for papers. And you're saying that right then and then, they started saying to people recruiting actively in the community?
That's right. Now we were essential workers. Now we were needed. Now when people, you know, were going home and were getting sick, or didn't even want to come and get exposed, we were asked to come in and take these jobs.
Wow. Always love listening to Maria in the field because it was just like a masterclass.
Yeah. Sending Maria out to the field is exactly where Maria Hinojosa needs to be. And I tell her that all the time. And you can just see from that clip. This episode is so powerful, so emotional. Mm-hmm. But listen, just hearing that and hearing sort of the memo from the Biden administration about stopping workplace raids. What are your thoughts, I mean, of all this, Jamila?
You know, it's not enough, obviously. I mean, I think the point that Lorena made about all of a sudden these workers being deemed essential workers in the middle of a international global health crisis, right? I think that is the through line that needs to be, you know, top of mind when we're talking about the people's livelihoods and people's ability to stay in this country.
Yeah.
You know, I'm looking at this from NPR. Immigration advocacy groups welcomed the policy shift, although groups such as the National Partnership for New Americans also renewed their call for permanent reform, including legal protections for millions of undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children and those with temporary protected status.
Yeah.
So, you know, Julio, I feel like we're having a lot of policy shifts that are trying to account for the fact that the pandemic sort of unveiled like how essential people are, especially immigrant workers are, to the functioning of America, right?
Yeah, I think that's the thing. You know, just hearing that clip with Lorena, you know, if you think about it, right? there was a raid in 2019, but then 2021 comes around and it's in the middle of COVID and they need workers. So now all these people are quote unquote essential. I think that's the big takeaway that no one's really talking about, or at least in the context of the pandemic, is how much is enough? What do these people have to prove to earn their pathway to citizenship, right? Now, you know, you're deemed essential workers. I would definitely argue that if it wasn't for the undocumented workforce in this country, our lives would have been dramatically different during the shutdown. Right. You know, anyone who gets food delivered, or, you know, you get your groceries delivered, like all those conveniences that people that have the privilege of doing that, who do you think is doing them? That's the big question I have. I mean, it's a great episode. I'm really glad that we went back to Mississippi, because from the perspective of the people that we've met down there, they represent sort of the new America. Mm. So a lot of these issues that seem to just get limited to the border crisis are actually happening day in, day out, right? And Mississippi is a perfect example. This is where people have their livelihoods. They want to raise their kids there. You know, they want to work. And the United States likes to sell itself as this beacon of freedom and opportunity. And here we go. You know, I'm glad that DHS is going to try to, like, shift the focus of these workplace raids. But, you know,
right.
Democrats have a history as well.
Right. Well, moving on to our second topic, going from Mississippi to Vegas, where the National Football League is in an uproar again. So in the NFL, there's been a lot of news this week because of the resignation of Las Vegas Raiders. That's still so hard for me to say, but Las Vegas Raiders coach John Gruden.
Do you want to just call out? Oh, it's okay to say Oakland.
They're the Oakland Raiders. They're not Las Vegas. They're not even LA. Sorry, LA folks.
Okay. Didn't you just feel good saying that?
You know, you just got to say it.
Okay.
So Gruden stepped down as head coach of the football team after emails reported by the New York Times and Wall Street Journal revealed racist, homophobic, and misogynistic comments he's made for several years about people involved in the game, including players, cheerleaders, and women referees, in addition to using offensive language to talk about other coaches, NFL owners, and journalists. So he was getting on everybody. There are also reports that Gruden exchanged photos of women in little to no clothing with Bruce Allen, who's the former president of the Washington football team.
Mm-hmm.
We know racism and misogyny in the NFL is nothing new. These emails came to light through an investigation of workplace misconduct being conducted by another team, the Washington football team, and were just part of 650,000 emails reviewed. And it's not surprising to see right-wing commentators fiercely coming to his defense.
Mm.
Jamel Hill, a contributing writer for The Atlantic, talked about this on Tuesday with Joy Reid on MSNBC. Let's take a listen.
Indeed, and in action, the NFL has shown over and over again that it's a racist league. He mentioned the segregation that were part of its roots, but also just in current day, to have only three Black head coaches, to have never had a majority Black team owner. I mean, it's been 101 NFL seasons, and they just got their first Black team president a couple years ago, who ironically is with the Washington football team. So in message, they sent it strongly. Black people are laborers. They are not leaders. And this is the scary scenario for any person of color, especially for Black people, and certainly for those in the LGBT community, is that they're constantly running into people with this mentality who have authority over our lives. John Gruden is able to decide the future of men. He is leading them, quote unquote, and he's in a position where he's interacting with them in a very intimate level. And to now know that this is what he really thought about them, here's what they think about you. It's really a slap in the face on a lot of levels. And think about it this way. You were talking about Colin Kaepernick. The NFL has basically made it known that there's always going to be a place for John Gruden, but not for Colin Kaepernick. Yeah. That's the message.
That is the message. Loud and loud, loud, loud and clear. You know, Julio, what's your take on this? Because I remember when Gruden was rehired, it was a big deal when the Raiders moved to Vegas.
Yeah.
They signed him to be the head coach, paid him a ton of money. And he was in broadcasting before this, right? So he was a longtime NFL coach, spent like 10 years in broadcasting. So he's a big figure with a lot of influence.
Yeah, he's a Super Bowl winner with Tampa Bay.
Right.
Two things I want to say about this. You know Carl Nassib,
mm-hmm.
who's the NFL's like first openly gay active player? He plays for the Las Vegas Raiders. But he actually like was excused from team activities on Wednesday, and I'm quoting the Washington Post. So think about that. It's when your coach is that flipping homophobic.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It's like you actually have a gay player on your team.
Right.
So that to me is number one. I mean, I do think this whole notion of the right wing defending him, and I think it gets to a bigger point about the NFL. I actually think it is the last sports league where the right wing actually like is fervently into the sport.
Hmm.
You know, I think the NBA has that train has left the station. Major League Baseball is not political. You know, let's just be real.
Right.
And the right wing's not going to follow Major League Soccer. You know, that's just, it's too foreign probably.
Right.
So the NFL, you know, it's this message of like Americana, patriotism. So the fact that they fucking flipped out and, you know, about mob mentality and thought police and all that, and don't really understand that Gruden, these were work emails.
Mm-hmm.
This was like, I even tell my kids, was like, don't say it.
Right.
Don't write it.
Right.
Like, number one. But the point about a league that is predominantly consists of black males, and here we go again. And the NFL likes to put its head in the sand.
Right. You know, I just keep thinking about this TikTok I saw, Julio.
Oh.
The joke was that the E in email stands for evidence. So look, if you want to be racist or homophobic or misogynistic, just don't put it in email, man. It just...
I mean, it's like, it's a work email, people. Of right. course, they're going to tell them to leave. All right, so let's move on to our final topic. Another one that dominated the pop media cultural circles this week, and that's the controversy surrounding comedian Dave Chappelle and his latest Netflix special, The Closer. So, I mean, I did watch it, full disclosure, because I was like, I need to see what people are reacting to. But I totally respect people that don't watch it. I know you decided not to watch it, right. Jamila, so I respect that.
Right.
So the special has received a lot of backlash because of Chappelle's homophobic and transphobic comments. And in response to the criticism, Netflix co-CEO Ted Sarandos defended Chappelle, saying content on screen, and I'm quoting, doesn't directly translate to real-world harm. But we know, I mean, hateful rhetoric can be harmful, and according to the Human Rights Campaign, at least 39 transgender or gender nonconforming people were killed in 2021 alone. All right, and we're in October,
mm-hmm.
right? And in the midst of all this, a trans employee at Netflix, Tara Field, who wrote a viral thread on Twitter about the special and the epidemic of violence against trans people, was actually suspended by Netflix along with two other employees for crashing a meeting at the company with top executives. I wish that was videoed, like people crashing a meeting like that. They've since been reinstated, the employees. And next week, trans employees and allies at the company are planning a walkout in protest of Sarandos' comments and the special itself. And we're going to be diving deeper into this topic on our upcoming show on Tuesday. But let's listen to what award-winning writer and trans activist Raquel Willis said on Zerlina Maxwell's show last week about this controversy.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that we have come to know Chappelle for is definitely being able to kind of push back against white supremacy. And that is something that he can do very powerfully as a black man. But I think he has this idea that he is nuanced enough, has enough of an understanding to kind of push back against transphobia and trans misogyny in whatever way that he says he's trying to do it. And he just simply doesn't have the range. Unfortunately, he paints the LGBTQ plus community as purely being a group of only white people. And so he doesn't interrogate the fact that actually when we think about the violence and the discrimination that black trans people and trans women, for instance, face, it often comes at the hands of black cisgender heterosexual men like himself, right? So if he was really going to do something radical with this special, he would contend with that tension that exists within the black community, something that he actually embodies a bit of being an oppressor in.
Can I say, having seen the special, I was about to give like a really good hot take, but then I'm like, Raquel Willis just did it for me. So anyway, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, look, I think that what's always powerful about these moments is that we see folks like Raquel Willis, you know, other folks, Roxane Gay, Saeed Jones, these really powerful black queer and trans voices coming to the forefront. And I wish we could just give those folks space, that same amount of space and opportunity when it's not in reaction to something, right? Like when it's not like reacting to very violent comments.
Like they should have their own Netflix roundtable.
Exactly.
That gets the same promotion as Chappelle. Like that's what Netflix should be doing, is like get these voices and give them the marketing machine that Chappelle gets.
But I do think that there's something else that's happening here to take a step back. And I think about the fact that this special is called The Closer. Dave Chappelle has sort of been back, quote unquote, after signing, you know, a multi-episode deal with Netflix several years ago. And he was gone for years, right? This was the whole thing about him. His mystique had grown. You know, he left Comedy Central, leaving millions of dollars on the table years ago. And I think what's happened in the years since then is that entertainment has shifted so that it is much more friendly and hospitable to creators, right? Like no longer do you have creators who are beholden to these like corporate, they are, right? But it just looks very different. And I think that what Chappelle is doing, he's doing very intentionally, right? If you look at every single special he's had as part of this Netflix deal, the space that his anti-trans comments occupy gets bigger and bigger and bigger, right? So I think that he is intentionally stepping on these landmines to provoke people, and he's definitely provoking people. But I think the bigger question is, what is the responsibility of an artist and a creator who's given a platform, right?
Exactly.
Like, it goes back to Charles Barkley in the NBA, like, you know, in the 90s. I'm not a role model, right? Are you a role model? What are you using your platform for? And I think Chappelle is making a case that he is not a role model, right? Like nobody should be listening to him. Mm. And we're in this moment where it is sort of accepted that if you have a platform, you will use that for the public good, right? You will not provoke, you will not denigrate, you will not create an atmosphere in which people's lives could potentially be in danger.
I think you're absolutely right. We're seeing sort of a transformation in entertainment and a more of an awareness. And as revolutionary as Chappelle was, we have to remember, you know, he in the aughts, I mean, he was the shit. I think he's also combating sort of that entertainment is shifting, right? Like exactly what you said. And and you don't have the range.
Right.
And that's what I mean with what Raquel Willis said. I was literally going to say what Raquel Willis said, because that is exactly, I think, the overall problem with the special in the end. And in the end, I mean, if you're not going to watch it, like I'll just reveal this. He does end the show with his relationship with a trans individual who that person had defended Chappelle. And then eventually that person committed suicide. And that's how he ends the show. Hmm. And it's almost like, well, I have trans friends. Like the way he used it. And I think it was intentional. I think you're absolutely right. I think he was just saying, like, I'm going to defend myself and fuck you because I have a Netflix deal and I got a lot of money. And then at the show credits, it's all these like pictures with him and all these like powerful wealthy celebrities. So, you know, Chappelle's into space. But anyway, we're going to talk more about it on Tuesday. So thank you again, Jamila, for being on.
Yeah, stay tuned.
All right. I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
And I'm Jamila King.
Uno, dos, tres.
And remember, y'all, go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us, because it really, really helps. And you can also listen to In the Thick on platforms like Pandora, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts. Check us out on the web at inthethick.org. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook. Tell your friends. And be sure to follow Jamila King's work on BuzzFeed News. So I want to see people tweeting out Jamila's work. I'll be watching you, listeners. I'm like a dad. It's like, better share Jamila's work. In the Thick is produced by Noor Saudi, Harsha Nahata, and our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow, Lisa Salinas, with editorial support from Mike Sargent and Charlotte Mangin. Our audio engineering team is Stephanie LeBeau, Julia Caruso, and Rosanna Caban. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional, Kept, and ZZK Records. We'll see you next time. Thank you for listening. Nos vemos.
Stay safe, y'all.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.